one thing we've lost as adults is that ability to use and engage the diaphragm. And it's very sad because when we're babies, that's how we breathe. They breathe with the belly. That's why it's called baby belly breathing. They breathe with the diaphragm. It's perfect. We've all done it. If you're alive, you've breathed correctly once or twice.
Welcome to another episode of the Wildertainment Podcast. I am so passionate about the topic at hand today, which is breath holding, underwaters, and freediving combined with spearfishing with an expert. So we're going to break down the science of breath holding. And one of the things that I actually just learned just now that we didn't talk about, but I wanted to share with you guys, is in our course, the Hold Your Breath Like a Helicopter Rescue Swim program, one of the things I taught was the recovery breath. So hook breathing, as they call it in the freediving world, where once you resurface from a deep or long underwater, you get to the surface and you go... three times, just like that. The theory behind it was that you're taking in that oxygen, you're holding it in, and it's allowing your body to diffuse that oxygenated blood, and it's preventing you a little bit from passing out. But from my conversation just now with our guest, it seems like that's evolved to now a more hope breathing technique. So you almost hear the word hope as you're inhaling. So that's the updated. No more hook breathing, the hope breathing technique. I feel so much more zen, so much more oxygenated right now. All right, without further ado, breath holding, free diving, one of my favorite topics with our guest, Luca Somaruga.
The rope is free!
What?
The rope is free!
Liam's fallen into a crevasse, and I immediately thought he's dead or at least seriously hurt.
And my guts had been ripped out of my body and were being contained by my flight suit.
I know a mountain lion is on top of me. This is pretty cool. We met at the coffee shop just a couple weeks ago. And yeah, at this point, I'm more of a climber, but my previous life, like we were just discussing, was all about the free diving world, the underwater world. But I thought that was really cool how you talked about a climber that you know that's a pretty phenomenal climber that you've now introduced to the whole free diving community. And he's already doing, what did you say, 35 meters?
Yeah, he's already easily crushing 35 meters, very comfortable at 35.
How do you say that correlates as like a climber to free diving?
Well, first off, the physical aspect of training is very similar, because if you want to climb a mountain, if you want to climb Mount Everest, or if you want to just go for high alpine mountaineering, my background was also in backcountry skiing and mountaineering at the same time I was developing my free diving. You have to train very similar things, and you got to train, one is hypercapnia, your hypercapnic tolerance, CO2 tolerance, the chemosensitivity of carbon dioxide building up in the body, also known as the lactate and lactate threshold. You know, so that's something that you really, really got to work on, because if you're carrying a 45-pound backpack at 5, 6, 7, 8,000 meters, your legs are going to burn, right? You're going to be building up a lot of CO2. You're not going to be able to off-gas that. So you got to train that lactate threshold.
How does he do that as a climber though? Because personally, I don't do that much cardio and defeating that lactic acid. I guess you're doing that in the forearm pump, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But how would you say he's utilizing what he's used in climbing and climbing training within the free diving world?
Well, he was also training for Everest.
Oh, gotcha.
When you're training for Everest, you're also training not just your cardio, your endurance, but you're also training, you're training that CO2 tolerance. You're also training the hypoxic tolerance too. Or you go to base camp, and from base camp, you go to camp one, camp two, and you are inducing these adaptations for high altitude, which means getting the body ready to function, metabolism, aerobic metabolism, to function at lower oxygen levels, because the air is thinner, there's less oxygen in the atmosphere. So you're training your body at the same time to function at lower oxygen levels.
What are they doing as far as their hypoxic training, their CO2 training? What are they doing to mitigate that lactic acid? Specifically, are they doing a lot of free diving technique?
That I'm not too sure, because I've never personally trained for Everest.
Yep.
I'm hoping to in the future.
Cool.
And I'm hoping to become a 100 meter free diver and then go for Everest with no supplemental oxygen, just cool. to show the importance of lung health and training. Yeah. But I have had, I was on a podcast with a fellow British climber who knows my friend Tim from Squamish. Yep. Tim was also on this call. And this particular British climber, he trained for Everest. I believe he did it without supplemental oxygen, but he used free diving techniques to train for his Everest ascent. And he was successful. And he was describing how he used very basic but effective techniques in free dive training to then go to Everest. And of course, once he got to Everest, he did his adaptation training, he did his base camp training, everything. But before, prior to going to the base camp, he was using free dive training to get himself ready.
Are we talking O2 tables, CO2 tables?
Exactly. Exactly. Cool. O2 tables, CO2 tables, staggered, not on the same day, gradual upgrading. Yeah.
We won't get too much in the nitty gritty of like what a CO2 table is. Well, yeah. Why not? Well, it's just a little bit. Give me maybe a CO2 table and it's super brief as to how that breaks down for training.
Yeah, a CO2 table, hypercapnic table as it's known. The goal of it is to really just get the body used to that increase of CO2 without off-gassing it. And you're never coming close to low oxygen. It has nothing to do with oxygen. Your body's always oxygenated when you do these tables. So essentially a good example would be you hold your breath for 1 minute, just 1 minute. Everybody can do that. It's very simple. But then you only take a one breath break in between. And then you hold your breath for another minute. And then you take a one breath break, and then you hold your breath for another minute. And by one breath break, I mean you exhale, inhale, hold your breath, 1 minute. Exhale, one inhale, hold your breath for 1 minute. Exhale, inhale, 1 minute. So you're not at any danger of passing out because 1 minute breath hold does not decrease the oxygen, the partial pressure of oxygen in the body. So you're good to go, but you're not off-gassing the CO2 as it's rising. So it gets gnarlier, gnarlier, gnarlier. And you can get a kick-ass workout doing this. It's also referred to as a Wonka table, I believe. By a guy named Richard Wonka, again, I think. And you get a kick-ass workout in just 10 minutes. Just nothing fancy. And you could do it with walking. You could do it with squats. You could do it with, I don't suggest doing it while driving a car, riding a bicycle, but you can play around with that kind of stuff too.
Yep.
So it's very effective.
That's very funny that you talk about that. Because especially during the pandemic and coming out with that hold your breath program, we're talking about that. You can do it if you don't have access to pool because all our pools are closed down, right?
Yeah.
You can do it walking. I was saying you can do it on your day to day. I was saying personally, don't do it, but I would do it driving, you know, and like, because, you know, you're there, you're in your commute, but it is dangerous.
If you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you don't know what you're doing, if you're hyperventilating, for example, beforehand, then it can be dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess speaking of hyperventilating, we should talk about just the risk of freediving. We're talking about some information that's very technical, but it is very dangerous. So I would love to know from an expert that breaking down the science of shallow water blackout, because that's one thing we always talk about.
Absolutely.
Break it down. So like what is occurring physiologically for your body to eventually shut down?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Like most people really can't grasp these concepts, especially when I say, well, actually, when you dive deeper, you actually have more oxygen. And they're like, wait, what are you talking about? When we breathe at sea level, very important, sea level, we have 21% of oxygen in the atmosphere. And most of the oxygen in our body is actually stored in our blood. People don't know that. People always say, oh, I'm running out of air. I can't hold my breath. Your lungs is just topping it up. We want to dive with a full breath, but most of your oxygen is in your blood. So when you dive deep and the pressure increases, what happens is the amount of oxygen you go down with in your body is fixed. But because of the increase of pressure, the overall partial pressure of oxygen in the blood is higher. This is known as Dalton's Law. Mm. It's basically the concentration because of the pressure. Concentration and pressure are two physical elements that are intertwined. Physics 101. Mm-hmm. So the deeper you dive, the more oxygen, the higher oxygen concentration you have in your blood. This is why scuba divers would never, ever, ever breathe pure oxygen and dive on pure oxygen. Because at a certain level, too much oxygen causes oxygen toxicity and you can die, it can kill you. Mm-hmm. So we never, ever do that, for example. Or at least scuba divers would never do that. So if you see a O2 tank lying around and you think, oh, I'm going to breathe pure oxygen and then go dive, you'll kill yourself. So don't ever do that.
Yep.
But in freediving, it's much more natural. We take a breath of air at sea level, 21% oxygen. And the deeper we go, because of the pressure, there's a higher concentration of oxygen in the blood, which is really, really fascinating.
Mm.
Which is what it explains how we can go down so long and so deep. It explains how people have now gone 130 meters self-propelled on one breath. How Andrea Zuccari, a guy I trained with in Egypt, has done 175 meters with a mask going down and back up. Clean, like he comes up, he looks cool as a pickle. No problem. You know, like 4-minute dive, but it was the depth that was more impressive.
I was curious, just, and I'm sure the audience is too, what is your PR right now for finning descent?
80 meters, 260 feet. 80 meters on
going
one breath.
Going down,
yes.
And up, right?
Going down and up, self-propelled, yeah, with fins. That's my specialty.
When you get down there, are you kind of looking up? I guess with your experience, you're like, I'll make it back up. But sometimes when you're that deep, I feel like I've only done it for depth a very few times. And when I was down there, I think, pretty out of breath now, you know, at the bottom. And then you have to make your ascent. Do you ever have that feeling of like, oh, am I going to make it back up?
Well, that's exactly where it ties into the shallow water blackout. Because when you're down there, you feel good because
yeah.
You actually have a higher concentration of oxygen.
Mm.
But you got to go back up. And when you start going back up, the partial pressure now drops because the pressure around you is dropping. You're going back up to the surface.
Right.
And that's where you can have a shallow water blackout. That's where you can become hypoxic. And in the last few meters where you can black out underwater.
Mm.
So if you don't know what you're doing, if you haven't taken a free dive course, if you find yourself hyperventilating, doing the Wim Hof stuff without really knowing how to tweak it, you can put yourself in trouble. Which is why in freediving we always say, you know, dive within your limits, never dive by yourself, you know, get some training and don't hyperventilate.
Mm.
So that's usually the rule of thumb.
Is it possible to still have a shallow water blackout when you haven't hyperventilated?
It is, but it's way more unlikely because the trigger mechanism that tells you to breathe, what gives you the urge to breathe, anybody that's ever held their breath and they get this immense sensation of I need to breathe, they start getting contractions of the diaphragm. It's beyond anything. It's a survival mechanism. It's your alarm system. It's beyond anything that you can hold against. That's actually the carbon dioxide building up.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have as much to do with oxygen as we think.
Yep.
So anybody that's holding their breath that didn't hyperventilate, they were just breathing slowly as if they're falling asleep, yoga breathing, as we call it. And you hold your breath and you get the sensation to breathe. That's your CO2. That's a natural evolutionary mechanism to making you breathe. And think about it from an evolutionary biology point of view. If we didn't evolve to have an alarm system to tell us to breathe that was independent of oxygen,
mm-hmm.
Well, we wouldn't have survived as a species. We'd be a pretty shitty species, you know what I mean?
True.
So that's that CO2.
Mm.
And that's at the same time what we train. That's how we train our ability to hold our breath longer, to get to know that urge to breathe, to get to know those contractions, to get to know that rise of CO2 in the body.
Right, yeah.
And hyperventilation just kind of overrides that. You can hyperventilate, off-gas CO2, and you can become hypoxic without ever knowing it. Basically, hyperventilation turns off your body's alarm system. Mm. So you got to be very careful with how you do it, especially near a body of water.
Right.
Yeah. Or riding your bicycle or driving a car.
Mm.
That I would never recommend.
I talked on that episode 72 that we were just talking about, something I got to experience recently, which is breath work, holotropic breath work is what they call it.
Yeah.
And that was my first time. Yeah, I never heard of it. Never heard that was a thing or it even existed. And yeah, it wasn't quite that fast what he had us do. So I'm sure there's different approaches.
Yeah.
He had us basically going.
Oh yeah.
Which means like there's no pause in between the inhale and the exhale. And it is hyperventilating. It's not quite that quick hyperventilation, that quick in and out, but it put my body in this rigor mortis.
Yeah.
My mouth was tight and he was saying, yeah,
cramping
my throat too. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's very cool. Cause at one point he told me to hold my breath and you know, I do have experience with the whole freediving situation, if you didn't know that per se, but, and I didn't even think of it that way in that moment, because I was in that like beautiful dark place, but he made me take a breath. And I guess they were kind of aware that, yeah, it was about like 3.5 minutes or so. All he had said was like, take your breath, hold it until you feel the want to breathe again. Right.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like me trying to push myself. It was just after a specific amount of time, I was like, that's enough. Like, it wasn't like, you know, when you're training free diving a lot of times, you try a little hard and try to think different like mechanisms of, or thinking patterns. I wasn't really doing that. I was just like, I'll do it until I don't want to
anymore. Yeah, exactly. Until you get that sensation.
But that's because I purge a lot of CO2. Yeah,
exactly.
Normally three and a half minutes
is very like, good, right?
Yeah. But that's like, I could still potentially do that now with like the lack of training without hyperventilating. But I'll say this, it would be a lot harder than having done it after that hyperventilation.
And that's fine, because it's controlled, conscious hyperventilation. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. I love the Wim Hof stuff. Even Wim says, don't do this when freediving. It's controlled, conscious hyperventilation. It's controlled. There's a teacher, there's a setting, you're learning. It's conscious, you're aware of the breathing you're doing, and you're hyperventilating, no problem. The danger is when it's uncontrolled, subconscious hyperventilation. When people don't realize they're hyperventilating, and then they decide to hold their breath and go underwater. Mm. That's the killer. Okay. So it's all about, it's just a tool in your toolbox. It's all about how you use that tool,
yep.
Right?
What is one of the first things that you see in a new student, new free diver, or just somebody new to the underwater world? What's like one of the first mistakes you see amateur swimmers when they first get in the water?
A basic lack of understanding of their own biochemistry.
Mm.
The fact that it's got nothing to do with the oxygen, your urge to breathe. I tell them it's your CO2.
Okay.
It's your CO2, it's your carbon dioxide. And that's what we want to train. We want to get to know that urge to breathe. So once they understand that knowledge, once that theory is understood, once the exercises are gone through, that knowledge is very powerful. Because the second the mind, the autonomous nervous system switches as you're holding your breath and you're in primal mode, but you're very relaxed, but you know, you start becoming aware of the urge to breathe, those dark thoughts start coming on. It becomes a mental game. And as the dark starts to start rolling in, the self-doubt, the lack of confidence, the what are you doing here? You're holding your breath. Are you crazy? The darkness that we all have can only be fought, so to speak, with the light. And I believe that light is the knowledge. Hey, I'm okay. This is the CO2. I'm very safe. I know what I'm doing. I've studied this. Relax, relax. Mm. So that's very, very powerful. Once people grasp that, they tend to experiment with their own bodies. And that's where I like to use the terms biohack, bioengineer. They find a way to biohack their own anatomy, and they start experimenting with this urge to breathe, with these different levels of CO2 they may have never ever felt. Most people have never even had a relationship with their diaphragm.
Mm.
You know?
Yep.
Just like a really good podcast between Joe Rogan and Laird Hamilton. Laird talks about how people will go to the gym and they'll be super cut, but they won't have any core strength. They won't have any understanding of how to actually engage the diaphragm and thus the core.
Yep.
And it's quite the irony, really. They'll only breathe with their chest.
Yeah.
Thus not taking a full breath.
Yeah.
So that's the big one.
Okay.
And also teaching students about the CO2.
Okay.
So in your example, the reason why you were getting crazy rigor mortis and you were getting like euphoric and lightheaded when you're hyperventilating, it has nothing to do with the oxygen. It had to do with the fact that you were getting rid of CO2.
Yeah.
And here's the fascinating thing that we didn't understand until very recently. Carbon dioxide is a very important vasodilator. It's perfect. We have a bag here.
Okay.
You ever see people when they're about to pass out, they're about to faint, they're about to get lightheaded, we give them a bag and we tell them,
yes,
breathe in a bag. Why do we do that?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought it's for your own thought to see the inhale and the exhale, so you see that you are in fact breathing and you're calming yourself down psychologically. Is that accurate?
Perhaps there is an element to it.
Okay.
But the biochemical aspect of it is that I'm breathing back my own CO2.
Mm.
I'm about to get lightheaded. I'm about to faint. I'm about to have a drop in blood pressure. I breathe my own CO2. CO2 is a vasodilator. It dilates the blood vessels. That means when I hyperventilate, I off-gas CO2. If I off-gas CO2, I am vasoconstricting. So I could be fully oxygenated, 100% O2 saturated. But if that blood with oxygen cannot get to the brain, I'm cutting off my blood flow.
Mm.
When you wrestled in the army and people would do the rear-ended chokehold and they would pass out. Why would they pass out? Because of oxygen? No. Because they would cut off the blood flow in the UFC. That's why we black out. When you're doing wrestling, jiu-jitsu, nothing to do with oxygen. So when you hyperventilate, you off-gas CO2. CO2 is a vasodilator. Less CO2, you vasoconstrict the blood vessels. You cannot send blood to the brain. You get lightheaded, dizzy, euphoric, and then you can black out.
Mm.
It's called cerebral ischemia. That's the medical term for it.
Mm.
You're cutting off the blood flow.
And when you vasoconstrict, is that why you're getting rigor mortis? Is because things...
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. You start vasoconstricting. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
How the breath can affect the biochemistry, the blood chemistry of the body.
Was interesting though, and explain this perhaps, but when he told me to take that breath, within a couple seconds of the breath hold, immediately things were loosening up.
Oh yeah.
But I wasn't breathing anymore. I was just holding the breath.
Yeah. Oh yeah. CO2 starts coming back up. Yeah. Now what's fun is if you start experimenting with that, in what we do in free diving, as we call it, intermittent hypoxic training, but you do it on empty lungs.
Yeah.
You do different waves of hyperventilation, and then you want to slowly taper off your hyperventilation because hyperventilation jacks up your heart rate. Mm-hmm. That's the downside. And if your heart rate is going through the roof, it's harder to hold your breath as well because first of all, you feel it. Second of all, the heart consumes 20-25% of the body's oxygen. So if your heart is pumping, you're actually, funny enough, burning more oxygen.
Right.
So you want to slow down the heart rate. And then we exhale everything and we hold our breath on an empty lungs. So this is a very advanced form of training. I don't recommend anybody starts off with this.
What's it called again?
Intermittent hypoxic training.
Okay.
It's the best way to get to know the sensation of hypoxia. And I believe I was talking to a student of mine that's a firefighter. They used to do this in firefighter training. I don't know if they do anymore, maybe for insurance liability reasons, but they would bring these firefighters to the rim of hypoxia so they could identify it. If you can identify it and acknowledge it, well, if ever in the field it happens, you can catch it and you can respond accordingly. Right? That's fascinating stuff, I find.
Have you encountered that in your freediving career and stuff?
For sure. I can feel when I become hypoxic.
Okay.
I can feel it coming. I have the awareness, I've trained the awareness to know when something's wrong.
Mm.
When I was younger, I used to have a drop in blood pressure and I would just black out in the middle of nowhere. I would syncope, as it's known.
Okay.
Sometimes I would convulse and then syncope.
I never knew how to pronounce that word. I would always say syncope.
Syncope, yeah. Syncope, yeah. It even happened to me once in Montreal. A few minutes earlier and I would have been dead because it happened in the subway stations of Montreal. Montreal, they have these very long subway stations like in Paris and London. They go super deep. And it's those automatic staircases, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was carrying a tray of sushi and I walked down the staircase and at the bottom of the staircase, blackout, fall on the floor. I wake up, bunch of people around me. I'm covered in sushi and I'd syncoped. I'd convulsed and syncoped. If it would have happened at the top, well, I would have tumbled and I would have been dead for sure.
Can you explain this science behind syncope?
For most people, it's just a drop in blood pressure. You'll see people go white. It's fainting. It's passing out. Drop in blood pressure, especially with people that have low blood pressure. For me, it was working too much, maybe the combination of sometimes drinking alcohol and smoking weed as well, overworked, overstudying, you know?
So it had nothing to do with actual freediving?
Nothing to do with freediving. This was before freediving.
Oh, okay.
But with freediving, I learned to identify it. Because I remember how many times I used to be in the kitchen, my friends would turn to me, I'd go white, I'd convulse, and I would just fall down.
Whoa.
This happened a couple of times. A couple times I almost hit myself on something. Once my buddy had to catch me, otherwise I would have smacked into a pan. Yeah. The combination of exhaustion, working, not sleeping, stuff like that. Oh. And with free diving, I learned to control. I learned to be able to identify it. So even to this day, when I give blood, since I probably have low blood pressure to begin with, when I give blood, and if I look at my own blood being extracted, I'm okay with blood. I used to work at an emergency room, so I've seen blood and guts. I'm okay with other people's.
Yeah.
But my own, if I look at my own blood being extracted, and I'm dumb enough to look, I will convulse, syncope. Whoa. Wake up in about 4 or 5 seconds.
Whoa.
Yeah, 8, 9 out of 10 times that happens. Whoa. Yeah, and I can feel it now. With free diving, I've trained myself to be like, oh, it's coming, and I tell the nurse, it's coming. Take out the needle, don't let me fall on the floor. Oh. Yeah, so you can train that awareness, like, ooh, you feel it.
What's the scariest moment you've had free diving?
Scariest moment was actually before free diving, bad surf accident.
Oh.
Which led me into free diving.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. 10 years ago, 2010. Yeah. Costa Rica.
What happened?
I was very young, I was very arrogant, stupid, naive, you know, egocentric, you know, immortal. You know, when you're young, you think you're immortal. I'd gone to this beach in Costa Rica, Dominical, did no studying, didn't bother to read up about the fact that it was one of the best, but also the most difficult and most dangerous surfing places in all of Central America.
Oh.
Just the way the beach is formed, the way the riptides, the period, everything comes in. And yeah, like an average of 20 afterwards, obviously, I'd learned after the fact, I'd learned that it was like 20, 21 deaths a year there or something. Whoa. So yeah, there I go. I just went, yeah, I can surf, grab a board, smoked a little weed. Yeah, what's so hard about surfing? I don't need to take a course. I'm okay. And I got my ass kicked. I mean, Mother Nature just showed it to me. The ocean was going to just swallow me up into every right she could have just taken me, you know? It was just like nonstop. Such a short period between massive waves getting pulled out with the riptide. It was like getting tumbled. Yeah, and I just remember darkness, quiet after a lot of noise, wanting to stay in the quiet, not wanting to go back in the noise. Middle of the day, it wasn't dark, but I remember just the tunnel,
yep.
The tunnel coming in.
Yeah.
And somehow, I don't know, I remember seeing some light and I went towards the light and I don't remember how I got out. I was half conscious. And then this 6'5" California guardian angel named Andrew just pulled me out. You know, it was actually funny. That beach was one of the first beaches in all of Central America to get a Coast Guard, not a Coast Guard, but a lifeguard service, volunteers. Oh, cool. Yeah. Because people were dying there all the time.
Yeah.
He pulls me out. He was like, oh, I thought I was going to pull out a body like last month. Same situation. Cool. You're alive. You know? Yeah. He thought it was like, oh, there's another one. You know, he had even called the car that transports bodies away.
No, not way.
Really the ambulance, you know? It's like, hey, Jose, it's another one, you know, whatever, in Costa Rica.
Whoa.
And they don't give a shit. They'll be like, oh, another stupid tourist that kills himself. Yeah, no, it was close. It was close. So for a while, I had a really weird relationship with the ocean.
Mm.
You know, a little bit of depression, stuff like that. Got over it. And then with freediving, I was able to reconnect with the ocean.
How did you overcome that? Because a lot of people, when they have those traumatic incidents, it takes at least a good amount of time, right, to overcome it.
Yeah, I think I stayed away from the ocean for a bit.
Mm.
And then slowly started getting back into it. Slowly started finding more humility, more balance, more acceptance. And just started going back into it little by little, and with free diving, that was the gateway. That was the path.
Mm.
That was the path forward. Otherwise, I would have never had a good relationship with the ocean. You can with scuba diving to a certain extent, but it's different. And just going back and doing the same thing, surfing, I would have always had that in the back of my mind.
Mm.
And in fact, a lot of big wave surfers are awesome free divers. They can hold their breath for 4 minutes.
I was gonna say, right? I've always been a terrible surfer, but at least the one thing working in my favor because I was stationed in Hawaii getting wrecked on these like double overheads.
You're calm.
Yeah. And like at one point it was really funny because this surfer, like elder-ish, comes up to me. He's like, "Yo, kid, are you doing all right out here?" And I was like, "I'm having a blast." And he goes, "You should probably get out of here, man. You're going to die." And I go, "I don't feel like I am. All right, one more and then I'm out." And then I got back out to the lineup. And yeah, my friend's like, "Do you know who that was?" And I forget the name for the life of me, but I guess it was like a pro surfer there at North Shore. And he like, and they're like, "What did he say?" And he's like, "He said I was going to die." So I had
Did you get an autograph?
Yeah.
It makes you calmer.
Yeah, it does.
It makes you, makes you understand the ocean and the waves better, the energy and the movement, I think.
Yeah. And you do need to accept it a little more. You're like, okay, well, this is going to be however long it's going to take.
Yeah.
I'm going to surrender to that. And I'm going to come up and then hope that the next one's right, not right on top of me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's when I teach surfing survival training, this is one of the concepts I teach in freediving. We learn about letting go, about acknowledging that real control means to let go.
Mm.
Don't resist. Fluidity, let go. A concept that I'm a huge fan of from Bruce Lee: be water, my friend, let go, be shapeless, be formless. And if you don't do that against the wave, if you don't acknowledge that the energy, the transfer of particles of energy from one particle of water to the next in one wave is more powerful than any energy you will make in your entire life. We can calculate that from an energy perspective. Like if you try to fight a wave, you're gonna lose always. No matter the size of the wave. So you got to let go. You have to have no resistance. You got to literally let yourself go as a spaghetti noodle while protecting yourself, obviously. But let yourself get tumbled and read the wave. And when you have a moment where you're not being dragged around like a rag doll, then you get out.
Yeah.
You think, you relax, you're more conscious. Get out of the riptide. Swim this direction. Don't swim again. Don't swim to the shore. It's not going to do you any good.
No.
Swim to the left. Swim to the right.
Yeah.
Analyze your surrounding.
So surfing survival?
Surfing survival training.
A course you teach.
It's a course I teach. Any intro freediving course you take is all about learning to relax, hold your breath, enjoy. Surfing survival is doing that to learn the connection with your breathing and learn to be calm and relax and hold your breath. And then we make you do exercises where you are loaded on CO2.
Mm.
And it is brutal. You're holding your breath and you have that urge to breathe coming nonstop. And we do exercises that essentially simulate wipeouts and stuff. And you're just like, you got to just relax through it.
What are some of those exercises?
One of them is like the washing machine, where you have in a pool of the appropriate size so you don't hit your head on any surfaces, you have maybe 4 or 5 people around you. And they're spinning you around, so you're getting dizzy as hell at the same time. And maybe you have time to take a little bit of air before they start spinning you around for, let's say, 30 to 60 seconds. And then you have a little bit of air, and then they keep going. So you have to relax and add through this urge to breathe, waiting for the next moment where you can take a bit of air.
Yep.
So that's a really good exercise.
Yeah, and they actually do that in the military.
Do it in the military.
Not specifically that much in the Rescue Storm program, at least not when I was in it. But they do it in, I think, like Air Force, PJ, and like maybe Navy SEALs and stuff. And they do it in those scuba diving courses where they'll twist you around and you got to untangle your scuba gear, get one breath, and they do it all over again.
For sure. Laird Hamilton teaches when he teaches his XPT training.
Yep.
Obviously, he charges a shit ton of money to go to California and some beautiful pool facing Malibu or something, and you do this training, but it's effective, right?
Cool.
And he has the right to charge what he wants. He's Laird Hamilton. You know what I mean? So, but that's what he teaches. It's basically free dive training, focusing on hypercapnia, CO2.
I thought it was very cool coming from my background in the military, and it's a lot of breath holding work. But again, the big part of that was elevated heart rate, trying to calm yourself down, and then doing an underwater. And typically it was never longer than a 25 meter on average, because again, your heart rate was so high and, risks. They don't want students passing out all the time, even though we would. But then going into the whole, I did like a PADI free diving course and actually took time, and then also educated myself into the science of free diving. It's really cool learning the science behind everything. And one of which was preparatory breathing, right? Like what you're doing before you go underwater. That's really where I like opened my whole view of everything. And I was like, oh, if only I knew that when my heart rate was elevated, right? But you as an expert now, what are you typically doing in your preparatory breathing process? Like before you're taking your dive, what's your breathing, your inhale and your exhale like?
Yeah, we used to call it preparatory breathing.
Yep.
We used to call it the breathe up phase.
Yep.
And now we call it appropriately the relaxation phase.
Ooh, I like it.
Because the most effective thing you can do, and when you watch professional freedivers, when you watch Alexei Molchanov, when he's about to go down 130 meters, all right, and do a world record, go down with a monofin and come back up. You look at the guy, he's sleeping for 10 minutes. He is literally shutting down his body and he's focusing more on the mind. He's focusing more on visualization techniques. He's keeping the mind positive, focused and aware of the present moment. He's not doing any fancy breathing techniques. Yeah, they'll throw in a few fancy little breaths here and there towards the end. But overall, it's really what we call tidal breathing. You're just observing the breath flow in and out. In and out. You could literally stand there and just say in and out, in and out, as if you're falling asleep. That's how you want to breathe, as if you're falling asleep for 10 minutes. Because the body's good at doing that. The body's good at actively inhaling, passively exhaling. Actively inhaling, passively exhaling. So you're more than anything observing the breath. Something which comes from meditation. You're observing, almost as a spectator from a third person point of view, yourself just breathing slower and slower and slower until the point where taking one last breath, a full breath, obviously, take a full breath, fill the belly, fill the chest, the mind doesn't see, it doesn't differentiate anything between breathing so slowly and so calmly to taking a full breath and then not breathing anymore. There's no alarm bells that go off. It's the mind is like, okay, yeah, cool. This is what we're doing. So that is incredibly effective before deep dives. And if you watch all the pros nowadays, that's exactly how they breathe. They're just sleeping for 10 minutes. They're shutting down the body. But it's a mental thing. It's a mental thing. Because if those demons start coming back and you cannot handle them, well, you have a 30-second window to take your last breath. So you got to keep the mind focused. There's no such thing as emptying the mind. You cannot empty the mind. Relaxation comes from focus and awareness. Something a lot of athletes call the flow state.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
But before that, just to a synopsis of what you just said, it almost seems like the optimal relaxation phase is to not make a big deal about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Very cool. Tidal breathing, yogic breathing, as it's also sometimes referred to, with different little variations. Just observing the breath, observing how the body can just fall asleep on its own. And that's one thing they teach in Vipassana meditation. Sit down for 15 minutes and just observe and try to visualize a molecule of air going in your nostril, out the nostril, in the nostril, out the nostril. Try to visualize that and try to visualize the visceral feeling of the nostrils with the air flowing in around the little circumference, the nostril cooling down because the air is a little bit humid. Maybe you're detecting smells and scents in the air that you otherwise weren't observing before. Using the senses to be present and mindful of your breathing.
The latter part of that breathwork seance that I did in that holotropic breathwork was, again, the hyperventilation, the breath hold, and then I believe it was deep breathing, but eventually he had us do, I can only describe as minimal breathing, where he was telling us to just take in as little as you need. And the whole time my mind was going to like, oh yeah, don't take more than you need from this earth. Exactly. Oxygen. And it was astonishing how little I felt like I was taking in or that I needed.
Exactly. Yeah. Because all the oxygen you need is already in your blood.
Right.
All you need to do is take one last full breath. And you go back to that relaxation. A full, comfortable breath, but you go back to it. It's a musical thing I always teach my students. It's a musical thing. Mm-hmm. And a musical thing, what I mean by that is that a good DJ, think about your favorite DJ. A real good DJ is defined by their transitions. From one song to the next, you're dancing with your friends and you don't even notice you're going from one song to the next. It's the perfect fluidity, perfect transition. Well, that's the breath. You're breathing, you're relaxing, you take a full breath and you go to and you hold your breath. And it was fluid. It's almost you didn't even notice. If you can do that, if you can achieve that, then you're truly relaxed and you're ready to go down underwater deep.
When you just did that whole, your breath just there, it took me back to when I usually take my breath. And tell me if this is good or bad, but a lot of times when I do take that breath, initially, I feel a little bit of a high, a little bit of a wooziness. And usually that turns into a good long breath hold, but I feel a little of the lightheadedness when I take that breath in. Is that a good thing or something to be cautious of?
You mean when you take that last full breath?
Yeah, I feel like within the first like 5 seconds of that breath, I'm like a little like, ooh, maybe it's a little excitement.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little, but it's something going on. I feel it a little bit in my head, a little wooziness.
That's actually quite normal, especially for people just starting off. And it still actually happens to me and other professionals from time to time. It's just an increase in the intrapulmonary pressure because you're taking a full breath. And it actually, what it kind of does is it kind of, not closes, but it kind of squeezes the arteries just for a little bit as you filling everything. And it just squeezes them a little bit. So you feel a little bit, ooh, and then it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this is very common in people starting off when they don't have the flexibility of the muscles and the cage that surrounds the lungs.
Oh, okay.
Something a lot of people are not aware of is that lung mechanics, your lungs can expand much bigger than you can know. Your lungs cannot grow in size. As an adult, they've stopped growing, but they're confined by this rigid cage, which is the rib cage, the diaphragm, the thoracic muscles here. And the more you improve flexibility of those by doing breathing exercises, by doing yoga, stretching, the more the lungs have space to expand and the more air you can take in one breath. This is known as the vital capacity. And you can go to the hospital and do a spirometry test,
right,
and you can calculate this. You can actually get real physical numbers. People that have had cancer, people that have had emphysema, asthma, they usually go to the hospital and they'll do a spirometry test.
Because what's the average in liters that an average person can hold within their lungs? Is it
6 liters for men?
I was going to say six.
Average adult, and for women, it's 4.5 liters.
But then some free divers have gone up to like 11. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've tested it. When I did my spirometry test a few years ago, it was 8.23.
Nice.
Without packing.
Right.
Which packing, we also don't want to do unless you're already a 40, 50 meter free diver.
Yeah.
Because then you can actually pack, and then cut off the blood flow and black out.
Right.
Which has happened before to many people.
It's one thing I didn't want to touch upon in that course.
Yeah.
I mentioned it. I was like, you know, there is an extra step that some people can do, but you're not going to have time to do this. That was more curtailed for people that are training in that military setting. So I was like, there's not going to be time for you to pack anyways.
No,
like,
just
don't bother.
It's more effective to learn to engage the belly.
Yeah.
And by when we say the belly, we refer to the diaphragm.
Yeah.
The belly is what we see. The diaphragm is what actually moves. And when the diaphragm lowers, the belly pops out and the lungs expand, air flows in. So one thing we've lost as adults is that ability to use and engage the diaphragm.
Mm.
And it's very sad because when we're babies, that's how we breathe. You look at a baby, they breathe with the belly. That's why it's called baby belly breathing. They breathe with the diaphragm. It's perfect. We've all done it. If you're alive, you've breathed correctly once or twice, actually millions probably of iterations, maybe not millions of breaths, but many, many breaths over, let's say the first 5 or even 6, 7 years of your life. Let's just say that. But for sure, when you were an infant and you were sleeping and you just diarrhea sprayed the bedroom and your parents are finally getting you to sleep, you were breathing with the belly. Why? Because you didn't have the intercostal muscles developed yet. You look at a baby's chest, there's nothing there. They're breathing with the belly. And then we grow older and we live in a society where we're told at a young age to sit down for 8 hours a day in school and study like this. And we're hunched over. And then we go to work. And what do? We do more of this bullshit. Guess what happens to a muscle you don't use? It atrophies,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we've lost this ability to engage our diaphragm because we're always like this. And we're always sitting down on a 90 degree corner, which is probably the stupidest invention from chairs to the toilet you have, is the dumbest thing we've ever created. Tell me where in evolution, when we were primates and before that, did we have 90 degree chairs? No, we squatted. We did what we call primal movements. Oh, sorry about that.
Right. I was just looking at the levels.
And we don't do those anymore because we're always sitting down. And so we stop using the diaphragm. We start hunching over. We start only breathing with our chest. We literally stop using parts of the lungs. The bottom part of the lungs, those alveoli, they're not getting any gas exchange. We start weakening our lungs. And then a nice virus comes along which attacks the lungs. Mm-hmm. What the fuck do you think happens?
Yeah.
Millions die. Of course.
Breathing.
COVID was horrible, but it did highlight two, I think, big problems in society. I would say, obviously, first world society here. Let's acknowledge our privilege. Pulmonary health, breathing, and mental health. Two things that free diving, climbing, all these other sports really focus on. So,
has there been studies on COVID and free divers?
No, but I've had COVID.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had COVID.
How do you feel?
It was okay. It was just a flu.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think that free diving, your breath work, the way you breathe, it helped you?
Absolutely. Yeah. For sure. 100%. But at the same time, I'm not one of those anti-conspiracy people. Yeah. I have seen COVID bring down on his knees my good buddy, who is probably one of the best free divers in the world.
Okay.
115 meter free diver, next UK champion. And I saw him, actually, I got COVID with him because we were living together in Egypt. I saw him like completely get wrecked by COVID.
Whoa.
And this guy is, I mean, he's one of the best athletes I've ever met. But for some reason, maybe his body was very stressed from training. Maybe his immune system tanked and everything came together just before the competition. And when he got the COVID, it hit him hard. Whereas me, maybe I was just a bit more ready from an immunoresponse point of view. So for me, it was just, the symptoms and that's it.
How is his recovery? Is he back up to par?
I think after almost 2 months, he's back up to par.
Cool.
Yeah, I think he'll be doing some pretty awesome deep dives, but he took it hard.
Mm.
Yeah, it's definitely something that is real.
You know, it's terrible of me that I know proper breathing techniques, but a lot of times, even then in my day-to-day life, I don't implement them. And one thing though I have started implementing is nose breathing. So like on my day-to-day, I'm pretty much now always breathing from my nose. I started the taping my mouth at night too.
Yeah.
I need to buy better tape though, because sometimes with the mustache at the time, it like feels off. So I got to figure that out.
I heard some people putting just a Band-Aid, like a really good Band-Aid.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe two.
Yeah.
So the sticky part is here and the soft part's not on the lips.
Yeah.
Is on the lips.
Okay, yeah. But I do sleep better. I feel better when I do that. Mm-hmm. But also what I'm talking about that I don't implement as much is, breathing from the stomach and, utilizing your intercostal area and activating that diaphragm. And I feel it. Like when you have more anxiety when you're doing your chest breathing and rapid breathing, right? Rather than these slow breaths. Because I did read that book, Breath.
Yeah.
Breath, yeah.
James Nestor.
And I think they were saying that he was recommending an average of, is it 6 breath per minute? Because on average, it's 12, right? An average human in EMT school, they always teach when you're making an assessment of someone's breathing, it should be about 12 breaths per minute.
It's too much. Mm. We overbreathe. And I think Patrick McEwen in The Oxygen Advantage talks about that too.
Okay.
We overbreathe. Again, because instead of taking long and deep breaths, we take shallow, rapid hyperventilation breaths and we breathe through our mouth.
Mm.
Of course, we're going to take a bunch of breaths. We want to breathe as slowly as possible. That's what yogis train to do. They literally train to breathe one breath cycle per minute. Think about that. For most people, the ideal breath cycle is 3 seconds inhale, 6 seconds exhale. So a whole breath cycle is going to be about nine seconds. So if you multiply that times 6, that's exactly where James is getting it from. He's actually getting it from a study which identified different breathing patterns and vocal patterns in different religions throughout the world. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, all the chants in many religions always followed that ratio, which is super interesting. The ratio of 1 to 2. Inhale slowly, exhale twice as slowly. Inhale for about 2 point something seconds, exhale for about 5 point something seconds, just round it up, 3 and 6. Inhale for 3 seconds, exhale for 6 seconds, twice as long. That's where he's kind of referring it to.
Right.
So yeah, if you do 3 plus 6, 9 seconds per breath cycle. How many breath cycles? It's about 10 seconds, yeah. 6 per minute.
Yeah.
So that's so for sure, 12 per minute is way too much breathing.
Yeah. Yet.
Way too much.
In all the medical books that I studied at the time, that's what they would say, 12
yeah, seconds. Absolutely. Yeah. And medical books from the 1960s used to say the human body cannot dive deeper than 50 meters because our lungs will collapse.
Mm.
I hang at 50 meters.
Yeah.
I chill there. Like yeah. My buddy Thibaut and mentor, one of the best freedivers in the world, he hangs at 100 meters for 1 minute, if you can fathom that.
Mm.
He pulls down to 100 meters, pulling down the line
yeah.
like an anchor. He hangs there for a minute, comes back up. I've seen him do this.
That's banana. So total. That's like 300 feet-ish?
300 feet, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 300 feet, you know. So total dive time, 4 minutes, 434. And what is he doing before his relaxation phase to prepare for this? He's breathing bloody slow, like super, super slow. He's shutting down his body.
One thing too, I talked about in the course, I forget the exact number. It was researched at the time, but an average untrained human can hold their breath for an astonishingly longer period of time than you would assume, which I think is about like, is it fair to say 2 to 3 minutes? Like if you're just breathing normally, calmly in your relaxation phase,
yeah.
you're untrained. Not saying like morbidly obese here, but you know, just a normal, regular person. You do a couple cycles of breath work, you know, whether that's O2 tables or CO2, you could probably pull off a 2 minute breath hold.
Yeah, I think with at least guidance and training, yes. But if you took your average adult right now walking around downtown who has no idea of any of this
yeah.
and you ask him to hold their breath,
no chance.
Within, they won't take a proper breath. They won't take a proper exhalation before the final inhalation. They won't relax. They won't have their mind in a good place. They could, I think 30 to 60 seconds max. You take an average infant or neo infant of 3 months old and you put them underwater, they'll automatically start holding their breath. Think about that. Remember the album cover? Nevermind,
yeah,
Nirvana.
Yeah.
That's what I was referred to.
Yeah.
You give me a baby and I put him underwater, he'll, on average, I think, hold their breath longer than your average adult.
Really?
Well, yeah, because it's, what were we doing in our mother's wombs for 9 months?
Mm.
We weren't breathing. You take a baby, throw him in the pool, and there's actually training for babies like this, because in the US, a lot of babies were dying, drowning in the pool. And of course, many lawsuits came on and they had the whole fencing of the pool, which doesn't work. Instead, people are saying, hey, why don't we train babies at a young age to learn how to flip themselves on the back? It's one of the best things you could do for your child.
It's one of the first things I saw when I was in the Coast Guard.
There you go.
Is I went to a pool and somebody was literally, it looked like he was drowning a baby.
Yep.
And I didn't know. I wasn't educated. It was like the first time in my life where I was like, I need to intervene. I need to do something about this. This is not okay. But it was really cool. You just kept, all these parents were bringing their kids and
yep.
kids looked like they're drowning. You're looking at them and they're like, oh my God, this is torture for an infant. But then they flip around and they take care of it. I mean, they're not looking like they're pleasantly having a good time, but like, you know, they're learning and they're flipping over and then they're swimming to shore.
Of course.
Yeah,
it's really cool. Absolutely. I mean, it's so instinctive for babies to do that.
Yeah.
You take a baby right now, you put him in the water, your own baby, ideally. Two things are going to happen. One, the glottis, laryngeal spasm, closes.
Yeah.
Two, the mouth shuts. The soft palate also closes. It's a survival mechanism. It's the same way if you take a baby, literally, and there's a study on this, you can find it on YouTube, the videos, and you make him grab a bar, and then you let him go, and he could fall and die. He'll hold on. Why? We're primates. He'll hold on instinctively. Yeah.
Babies just got it going on.
Yeah. And they know how to do that. So if you train that at a young age, you're giving a better chance of survival to a young child that could be in a drowning situation, blah, 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 you know? So it's way better. Whereas your average adult, why do people drown? What's the number one reason people drown? adults in cold water, fall off a boat.
A hypothermia?
No way. Very hard to get the body hypothermic. Number one reason people drown when they fall off a boat? Panic, cold water aspiration. Oh, yeah. They aspirate cold water. They literally put water. They panic, water into the lungs. They drown themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Second thing
about drowning.
Yeah.
That feels so stupid.
people literally, they'll cold water, yeah, aspirate the water, and they'll fill the lungs with water.
It's so just not a physical thing for me to have. Like, I'll get a breath full of water once in a while, but then it shuts down. It's like, no more.
Yeah, of course. Because you've trained to just be, no, yeah. I'm not going to open this, you know?
Yeah.
Second reason people drown in cold water? Hypothermia?
I don't know, is it?
Not yet.
No?
The claw. Whenever you hear somebody saying, I can swim, I don't need a life jacket, you could be Michael Phelps. If it's cold water,
oh yeah,
after a certain while, your blood vessels close. It's called peripheral vasoconstriction. What happens in freediving? You could be Michael Phelps in 20 degree water. After a certain amount of time, and you can train this, that's the best part about it, you cannot move your arms and limbs. You are going to sink like a stone. Again, you could be the best swimmer. After a while, you can't use this. And people, you can, when you do the famous cold mile race, you can feel it, right?
And that's why the safety boats. I'll say this.
That's why the safety boats.
I felt super idiotic a couple of years ago. I took a canoe out with a friend of mine, and I think it was late fall, if not spring. Water was frigid cold. We took a canoe out, and canoes are fine, but you should stay by the shore. And if you cross across a lake, which we did, you better hope there's another canoe or another boat around.
Sure.
We didn't. We just went for it, and I should have known better. But we were already like halfway across, and I was like, oh man, it's choppy water. I was like, oh. And the girl I was with was like pretty casual about it, and I didn't want to freak her out more, so I was like, oh, keep it to myself a little bit. But on the way back, she was making some movements. I was like, just so you're aware, there's a pretty high risk that we're in right now. Yeah. I need you to be aware that if this canoe flips, there's no flipping it back. And yeah, I'm a good swimmer, and I think you are as well. But the chances of us swimming this, like, it's probably like a mile and a half to shore.
In frigid water.
I'll tell you this. I can't pull you out.
No.
I might make it. And then hopefully we can get back to you in time. But I'm just saying, it's a pretty dangerous situation that we're in right now.
That's why they train in the Coast Guard, right?
Yeah.
Tread water, cold water.
Yeah.
In a controlled, simulated environment. And we are going to see the failure of your limbs. How is it? 45 minutes? Oh, good to know. Now we got to train to get it up to an hour.
To be fair, we didn't actually do that much training.
You didn't have a
training?
Yeah. Sure. Too bad. But I'm sure you've trained since then.
Oh, we have. And we would do that on our own time. We'd always be like doing the prolonged periods of time in the cold water and stuff
Past year, my buddy was telling me there were two like professional triathlon athletes that for some reason decided in the Howe Sound to not go back with the paddle boards, to swim back, and they died.
Yeah. It's so quick, those fingers, it becomes a fist in no time. Yeah. And then eventually, you're just swimming with sticks, and then after a while, your sticks go away.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare.
Anybody see Titanic?
Yep.
Same thing. Hello.
Jack could have fit on there.
He couldn't even fit on there.
He could fit on there.
He could have fit on there. That's why you need a life jacket.
Yeah.
Third reason people die. Cold water? Hypothermia?
I don't know.
Not yet. Doesn't
seem like it.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Post shock.
Okay.
They pull people out.
Oh, yes.
They warm them up artificially. Mm-hmm. They make them stand up. Mm-hmm. The blood vessels dilate. Yep. The cold blood rushes to the heart. Myocardial infarction.
Yep.
You just saved the guy and then you just killed him because you didn't, heat him up slowly, keep them laying down. That's why they always say, you're staying laying down until I write you off to a physician in the hospital.
Yep.
And then the fourth reason people die is hypothermia. It's very hard to get the body hypothermic. Think about getting the body severely hypothermic. Mm-hmm. It's actually harder in women than men too. There's a famous British swimmer. She swam the English Channel with no wetsuit many times. She swam in Antarctica in -1 degree centigrade water. She swam for like half an hour, like I don't know how long. Can you imagine that? In Antarctica, because of the salt concentration, the water is -1. Oof. And she's there. You can see it. I think her name is Sarah Cox, I think.
Oops. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. And she's just swimming in a bathing suit in Antarctica.
Oh, why amazing. Do that to yourself?
Well, she's trained for it. She's, you know?
Yes. So. I hate trained. Cold water now.
You hate cold water?
Yeah. I don't know. I should just get back into it.
Cold showers. Cold showers are very healthy.
I don't do it anymore. Yeah.
Cold dips. Cold dips in the...
Don't get me wrong. I love it. Every time I do it.
Yeah.
But I hate it right before.
I mean, for rescue swimmer, you have to.
I think it's why. I think I associate it with the job a little bit now.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. But, you know, I still do love it though. As soon as I'm immersed, I'm like, this is exactly where I need to be. And then this is where I belong.
Yeah.
But like leading up to it, I'm always like, oh no, I don't want to do
cold
this.
Cold water.
I don't know what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I find you lose the adaptation quickly and you gain it back.
Mm.
So I was in Egypt for almost a year. It's pretty warm water. And when I came back, I was like within a few days putting myself in 8-degree water. Oof. And it came back quickly, you know? Mm. It came back quickly. I think it has a lot to do with the mind as well, too.
Speaking about the mind, the longest portion of our course, that breath holding course, is, I think I called it Find Your Happy Place. That's all it is.
Nice. Yeah.
Now, yeah, let's talk visualization. Because if you were to break it down in percentage, underwaters or breath holding or free diving, what would you associate the mind to the entire success of a successful free dive?
It's incredibly important. Absolutely. I would say at a certain point, you've trained your body, and then you almost have to not neglect the physical training. You got to keep doing your physical training. But if you neglect the mental training, you are not going to go anywhere. Mm. The mind is it's its own place. It can make a heaven of hell or a hell of heaven, right? Milton, I think. Mm. And you got to train that. You need to train the mind to be able to enter a state of automation, familiarization, also known as autopilot. That's the reason why climbers, they'll do this. They are familiarizing their mind. They're building the connections as they are visualizing the climb. What's fascinating is that the mind cannot discern between imagining something and actually doing it. It cannot discern between imagining something and actually doing it. Your mind will not notice the difference if you imagine grabbing that cup, bringing it up to your mouth and drinking from it and actually doing it. But the way you visualize that is incredibly important. If you just say, yeah, I'm grabbing the cup, no. You need to use all the senses, details, details, details. Otherwise, it's fake. Otherwise, visualization doesn't work. So you need to visualize grabbing the cup, feeling the grittiness of the mug, and only you know that mug because you've held it and you're familiar with it. And then the warmth just before you take a drink, the warmth of the steam entering the nostrils, the warmth touching the lips and then the tongue, you know, of the fluid. So it's very important that we acknowledge that. And there's many studies on this. One of the famous ones is a 3-point basketball shot study, where they took a control group of basketball players, all at the same level. One of them, they made them do nothing. The other one, they made them practice 3-point shots. And the other one, they made them visualize professionally doing the same movements. And when they put them together, the ones that visualized and the ones that actually practiced, the results were incredibly similar. So the power of visualization is immense, immensely useful.
Hmm.
Again, remember, a skier dropping down the line, they will visualize the line. They will visualize it in great detail, the feeling of the snow, of the turn. They know exactly the sensation of the boot as it gently torques against the binding as they do the turn, and the feeling of the powder, you know? Everything is ephemeral. Ephemeral? Is that a word?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But what are you saying? Are you saying you need to visualize before a breath hold and before diving, you need to visualize the pressure on your ankles as you propel the fin, yes, the movement of your hips, of your entire body as exactly a fluid snake. Like you're saying, you need to visualize, and that's what's going to help you,
yep,
with a longer breath hold or deeper dive, visualizing and picturing yourself, feeling the pressure on your lungs, feeling what it's going to feel like, the temperatures as it gets colder as you get lower.
Yep.
That helps.
Spot on. 100%. Mm. The same way, again, a skier visualizes that line, a climber visualizes the holds and the quartz crystals against their fingertips. You are familiarizing and automating the mind. Because, and I quote my buddy Gary on this, he told me, Luca, the brain in 1/500th of a second can put on its defense mechanism. When the brain detects something that is, it's not comfortable, unfamiliar with, it will put on a defense instantly without you even acknowledging it. So if you're in an unfamiliar environment, you're going to tense up and that can lead to injuries. Mm. So visualization means I am repeating the actions, I am familiarizing my mind, the actions before I actually do them. Because there's only so much practice you can do. There's only so many dives you can do. There's only so many climbs or skis you can do. But visualization is infinite. You can have millions of iterations in your mind where you visualize, familiarize yourself with everything you just said. The feeling of the fins, the water flowing over your face, the sound of the carabiner on the lanyard zipping down the line behind you. You familiarize the mind, and the mind feels basically like it's already been there. The mind has already done it. The mind is familiar with the environment.
Isn't this preemptive, though? I understand that you need to be present and be present to all those five senses as you are diving. Mm-hmm. But what are you doing when you're in the dive? Is like, what's the technique? I always thought you should kind of, in a sense, try to defeat the mind's patterns, the mind's dark patterns. But what are you trying to think about in the moment of the breath hold?
Well, I think that's where it changes for a lot of people, right? It's incredibly subjective depending on which free diver, and obviously there's way better free divers than me, much, much deeper, and I have tons of more work and learning to do myself. But for me, pre-visualizing the dive and the successful outcome, that was huge. Mm. And this is a lot of Olympic athletes do this. They visualize the outcome and they visualize themselves succeeding. They've already done it. Mm. So if the mind thinks, what am I worried about? I've already done 85 meters. I've already done 90 meters. You've never even come close to doing that. I've already done a 514D climb. You've never even come close to that. If the mind starts to believe that it is completed the task, it is done, it is in the pocket, then everything gets much easier.
Mm.
It is familiar with it. And that's why a lot of Olympic athletes and a lot of athletes in general will have, like, I have won the Tour de France. They write it in their wall. They put statements of affirmation, as I believe they're called. Successful statements of affirmation. I am the best. I am a monster, as my buddy Thibaut used to say. But in a good way, of course, not a weird monster. I am a world champion, you know? And you put that everywhere in your mind and also physically written in your apartment, and you start to believe it. You start to believe it. The same way that a psychopath believes that murdering children is okay. It's incredible, the endless power of the mind. You can use it for greatness and you can use it for evil, so to speak, right? Mm. And even that is relative, but of course, murdering children is not good. But that's the power of the mind. Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing. I call that in my own head when I do it, I call it ego tripping myself. And and what it is and what I'm doing, usually this comes about in training, but I should implement it in just normal climbing. I'll think of a phenomenal climber like Tommy Caldwell. I always picture him a great finger strength, good power, especially when I do a dynamic move and I look at it, I'll be like, I am Tommy Caldwell.
Yes.
And then I hit that hold and I'm like,
fuck yes. Yeah,
that was easy because I'm Tommy Caldwell.
Absolutely.
On to the next. Yeah.
Absolutely. When I do free immersion, for some reason, I think I am Rest for Soul, little Japanese free diver, world champion. Her name was Sayuri Kinoshita. She passed away, unfortunately, but she passed away for other reasons.
Yep.
And she used to dive so soft. She used to do 90 meters just coming up like this. La, la, la. You know? So in my first, I don't know, 40 meters coming up, I'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going to do like Sayuri, nice and small. Nice and small movements to kind of protect my lungs. And I'm visualizing myself just like her. And then when I start coming close to the shore, I'll do more boom, more big glides and big pulls. So I'll imagine myself as William Troubridge, world record free diver, really good in free immersion, pulling on the line, and he would just do one pull and he would go flying. So you visualize yourself as that person you want to be. Mm. Absolutely. That successful affirmation.
And it does make you feel more powerful.
Oh,
more.
Man. Yep. Look at that fight with in the UFC recently. It was two women. One of them was American. The other was a Chinese girl. The Chinese was known to be indestructible. And people were like, yeah, she's going to win. She's going to win. She's going to win. The little American girl, this is UFC, professional MMA fighting. The little American girl with, I think she had a Spanish-Mexican last name. I forget her name. She was bald. Her head was shaved. She walks into the ring and she's like, I'm the fucking best. I'm the fucking best. She's just repeating it over and over. She was getting herself riled up. I'm the best. I'm the best. And she was believing it. And that made her focus and gave her the confidence, the lack of self-doubt to literally destroy her opponent. It's very powerful, the mind. And that's what Muhammad Ali used to do. That's what Mike Tyson used to do. They would get in their opponent's heads. And when the opponent would lose the battle in their own mind, well, what would happen? They would lose the relationship with the breath.
Mm.
I used to box many years ago, and I remember that when you lose the breath, you've done. You've lost. You've killed yourself. You've defeated yourself. The second you stop being in control of your own breathing. And one of the ways you can do that is with here.
Mm.
So Muhammad Ali used to get into the minds of his opponents. Mike Tyson, some of the greatest fighters ever, used to get into the minds of their opponents. And that's what they would do. You defeat this. This is connected to the breathing. You could have a cardio like Nick or Nate Diaz, and you're done.
Mm. One thing that we often would say in the military there was look strong, be strong. And what that is basically whatever you're exuding, whatever you're making yourself believe that you are, mm-hmm. whatever you're showing, eventually your mind and your body will start to believe it too.
Yeah, David Goggins.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it would put like me walking out to these challenging tests. To be fair, if we were really to dissect down deep, I was scared. I was afraid. I was questioning whether my abilities were going to get me through that phase. But at the surface, I look like a pit bull. I look like a stone. I look like I was going to tear anyone's head off
yeah.
that came across in my path, and nothing was going to stop me. Yeah, look strong, be strong.
Yeah, you're giving me goosebumps.
yeah.
That's right. And the 40% rule in the military?
What's the 40% rule?
Well, I'd read that like you train to be like, once you can't go anymore, once you're done, you're only at 40%.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard of that in a long time. That was like, yeah, in 2014, they were talking about that 40% rule.
I guess it's just a random number, but I think the point of it is when you think you're done, actually, you don't even know how much more you can go.
Yeah. Well, the military also, like in these challenging tests, like BUDS and all that stuff, they're always addressing that it's mostly mental, right? They always say 80% mental, 20% physical.
Nice. Yeah.
I've always said that is a luxury that individuals that have become dedicated and disciplined enough to become performing athletes physically have the ability to now say, yes, it is 80% mental and 20% physical because they've trained enough to be in shape. And now it is where the challenge lies.
Yeah.
Is, am I going to make it through this entire journey of 4 months of this hell? Am I going to make it through this night, right? You can, you could, you would be able to if you're able to overcome that mind, the mindset that's the struggle at that point. But as far as the 40% rule, I forget what that was all about.
But the affirmations thing, the visualization thing is very powerful. Even David Goggins talks about it. For him, it was like visualizing himself standing and being a Navy SEAL graduate. Mm. Just being up there.
Yeah.
And that got him through from being incredibly obese and out of shape to being, you know.
What about distractions, though? Is that a good technique or something to avoid as far as when you're in that desperate, I don't want to be here anymore, underwater. Is it good to have those distractions? Because one thing I would do is like play a song in my head,
mm-hmm.
Or just, you know, looking at the beauties around you and being present. But basically these kind of these distractions, if you will, or something to occupy the mind. Is that a good technique?
Yeah, absolutely. And people have different ways. I know one thing that worked for me was, especially when I did my 79, 80 meter dive there in Egypt during the last competition, for me it was, okay, going down, I'm super relaxed. I'm really in the fluid state. I'm focusing on the water flowing over my face. I'm working on equalization because, as you know, that's the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. I'm really just focusing on equalization. I'm visualizing myself, equalizing all the different elements involved. What is my tongue doing? What are my cheeks, my jaw? I'm visualizing the water flowing over my face. And almost as that happens, I reset any tension that I've scanned throughout my body. And that really keeps me just present. But when I turn and I wake up, or when I hear my alarm saying, beep, beep, you have 10 meters to go. Beep, beep, 5 meters to touchdown. And I turn and I grab that tag. That's where you can have a realization of, oh, fuck, you're deep. And if the mind goes to quantifying that depth, very important, quantifying that depth rather than qualifying it. If the mind goes to quantifying that depth, I have 80 meters to go. 80 meters is how many stories? 80 meters is how many trees in my backyard? 80 meters is how many apartment buildings in my neighborhood? You're fucked. It's too much. The mind collapses. I think it's a concept called narrow-based focus. You give me a marathon runner, professional, and if they think after 41 kilometers or 40 kilometers, let's say, if they think I have two more kilometers to go, they know what 2 kilometers feel like. They sensitively, physically, psychologically have a connection with what those last 2 kilometers feel like after running 40 kilometers. And if they think I have 2 kilometers to go, the mind collapses, even if the body could have kept going. So they have to stay focused on narrow, small tasks. Get to that tree. Get to that tree. Done. Get to that lamppost. Get to that lamppost. Done. Little tasks. The mind can handle little tasks. So in free diving, for me, when I would turn, grab the tag, if my mind went to, you have 80 meters to go, and I know there's other free divers that think this way too, I could be in trouble. So I do not have 80 meters to go. There's no such thing as 80 meters. I'm not deep. I have 100 kicks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 30. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I just need to put 100 kicks of work. That's it. That's how I get back. 100 kicks. 100 kicks. I know this doesn't work for all free divers, but maybe for people that used to be engineers who have analyzed and have very left brain focused, or were very left brain focused, so to speak, very analytical, overly pragmatical sometimes, I've noticed this helps for me. Again, maybe not for everybody, but that narrow based focused approach, that I'm not doing 80 meters, I am just doing 10 kicks, and then another 10 kicks, and then why the fuck not another 10 kicks, and then, oh, look at that, I'm halfway. I think that can be a very useful solution.
That's why we always teach to keep your head down, not only to minimize on drag, but just because your objective is almost always going to seem much further than you initially anticipated it being, right? So yeah. Don't even think of the objective, just think of the task at hand.
Yep.
And then you'll be there when you're there.
Exactly. Yeah. If you start looking where you are and you start engaging all the different receptors and trying to visually, you know, understand the world around, yeah, you can get in trouble.
When you're going as deep as you are, there is no finish line. You probably can't even see it from the top.
You can't see it.
It's down there. Your journey is almost endless, but when you're there, you'll be there.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Beautiful thing.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And I want to make it very clear that I'm just at the very beginning of this journey. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I still have so much work to do. I'm going to have so many failures ahead of me. and hopefully I can overcome them, but I'm just at the very beginning of being able to understand, and I've been lucky to surround myself with high-level athletes that have been able to teach me these things.
It's really cool too when you can be present with the fact that progress isn't linear, right? And you can actually have a smile when you have those failures of, oh, wow, okay, well, it's not as good as it was 2 weeks ago.
Absolutely.
This is where it is. And if it's really that continuity, that dedication to continue on, that's what makes somebody an expert at something. You can't just take that failure as like, oh, I'm getting worse. This is part of the process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if there's any free divers that are listening to this or anything, like, or even you in your free diving, when you go from that resistance to fluidity, when you make that change, that mental barrier, that mental jump, at least I went from pushing 60, 65 meter dives, like resistance, pushing against Mother Nature, to coming up, feeling like a garbage dive, having a lung squeeze, spitting blood, hurting myself, to going to much deeper dives, feeling way, way better, coming up, feeling amazing. And then going back to doing those 65 meter dives and hanging there, being like, what's 65? It's not deep. I'm hanging at 65. When I was able to do a 30 second hang at 65 meters, I knew that 15 seconds deeper at 1 meter per second, therefore 15 meters deeper, 80 meters, it was in the bucket. It was done. It was mine. I owned the depth. I wasn't just doing a depth. I wasn't just doing a number. I was owning it. I was belonging. I was allowing myself to be there. So that was very, very big change.
Let's finish this with the visualization technique, the body scanning that
body
you talked
scan.
About.
Yeah. Yep.
Tell me about it. So this can help with sleep is what you're telling me?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is actually something they teach in I teach the Molchanov's program. Okay. So you have SSI, PADI, NAWI, ADA. There's a bunch of different freediving education programs, but I believe that one of the best ones today is the Molchanov's.
Okay.
Just because it's literally taken the best instructors and athletes in the world and put them together to create a dashboard and a platform similar to what you have with Rescue Swimmers.
Yep.
It's an incredibly in-depth platform. I can actually just sign you up and give you some access to some of the exercises.
That'd be good.
They're incredible.
Cool.
Like literally you're doing exercises that world-class freedivers are doing to go really deep or do amazing breath holds, you know. This program teaches courses, and even in the first level course, they teach the visualization, the body scan to get the mind ready. What it is essentially it acknowledges that you want to be able to scan your body for any points of tension, because we hold so much tension in areas that we don't even realize. We have very little body awareness. Unless you're someone who does a lot of sports, a lot of yoga, a lot of meditation, we have very little body awareness, the average person. So to be able to scan from the toes upwards and try to scan, imagining you have an x-ray machine, or imagine like you're laying in the shade and the sun is slowly coming over you, very slowly, and bringing the light over you. And you can actually feel like, oh, my toes are in the sunlight. There's the warmth coming back. You know, you can visualize that. And you're scanning your body from the extremities. I like to do it from the extremities inwards. This helps to acknowledge the fact that maybe I was holding tension in my wrists, in my elbows. I let my arms go. Maybe I was holding tension in my calf, in my ankles. Well, I don't need my legs right now. I'm falling asleep. I'm about to hold my breath. I'm floating on the water. Why would I need to hold up my arms and legs? I don't need them right now. I can survive without arms and legs. God forbid that accident ever happens. You can survive as a paraplegic. No arms, no legs. So you scan and let them go. You acknowledge that you control your fingers, and therefore to real control means letting them go. You don't need them right now. You're sleeping or you're about to go dive. You don't need them right now. Just relax them and you let them go. So you scan little by little every part of your body, visualizing every little part, and you're just letting it go. I like to do it again from the extremities inwards. And then I get to the hard part, the belly, the hips. We hold so much tension in the belly. Can you scan your stomach and just be like, ah, let it go? The shoulders, the neck, the face. Let everything go. Relax the neck. Let your head drop down. Relax the shoulders. You can visualize somebody giving you a little massage little by little, and everything is being released as you're turning into, literally, I like to imagine a spaghetti noodle floating on the water. No tension. And I'm aware of tension. Oh, am I holding up my neck? Why am I holding up my neck? Okay, that's okay. I acknowledge and I accept. And I let go. I'm never mad at myself. And that's the problem a lot of people don't understand, is self-frustration is very counterintuitive to the improvement of anything. Because, and this is something, Atomic Habits, he wrote a book. It's a really good book called Atomic Habits. You get mad at yourself for doing something you don't like, a habit, a bad habit. And then you acknowledge that you're mad at yourself, and you're mad at yourself for being mad at yourself. And then you get mad because you were being mad for being mad. And then it becomes a downward spiral of self-hatred and self-destruction.
So I identify to that so much.
Yeah, we all do. We all do with our vices, right?
Yeah.
To be able to accept, acknowledge, and let go means, okay, there's a dark thought. That's fine. It's part of me, but it's just a thought. I'm going to let it go. And the same can be applied with your own body. Okay, I was holding tension because maybe I'm a bit stressed or something. Okay, that's okay. It's my tension. It's my body. Therefore, I can let it go now if I want to. Mm-hmm. And you scan your body until you reach the face, the jaw, the tongue. And everything is just melting away. You can imagine you're melting away in your mattress and you will fall asleep. Or you take one last breath and then you go down.
What about breathing in that process? Is there breathing that you should be combining, or only focusing on being relaxed, breathing normally while doing your scan?
Exactly. Okay. You're observing the breath. You're almost a spectator, just watching yourself breathe. You don't need to modify the breath. The body's really good at maintaining homeostasis, equilibrium, if you want to think about it. The body doesn't need you to maintain equilibrium of the pH in the blood, of the temperature, of the alkalinity. The body can do that on its own. It's very good at doing it. You just need to observe yourself breathing, watch yourself breathing. Yeah. And a lot of meditation, a lot of people that really practice meditation seriously. If you've ever read Siddhartha, Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, people describing these out-of-body experiences where they see themselves as a bird watching themselves. Well, that's exactly it. You become a spectator. And I do believe that once you reach the enlightened phase of meditation, which I'm nowhere close to, people talk about being able to watch your ego, to observe yourself from a third-person point of view. And I think maybe some religions believe this is how you achieve nirvana, how you go to heaven, you know, or Valhalla, or whatever. And you observe yourself. You're disconnected. The yogis, the real yogis, the real gurus, that's what they have become. That's what they dedicate their lives to just being accepting and indifferent, which is, oddly enough, very similar principles in Stoic philosophy. And Stoic philosophy is very, very fascinating, I find. Mm. Yeah. Can you be accepting with yourself, but also indifferent at the same time? Kind of went on a tangent there, but yeah, that's the body scan visualization, where you can really reach the state of just letting go, observing, just letting go.
Mm.
Yeah.
Hey, I learned a lot today.
Hey, thanks
so much. How can people learn as well, follow up with you?
They can reach out to me. I teach here in Vancouver and Squamish, Sea to Sky Freediving.
SeaToSkyFreediving.com, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Cool. SeaToSkyFreediving.com.
Cool.
You can even just type in Freediving Canada on Google and I'll pop up. And that's where I teach people about freediving, but also spearfishing.
Cool.
And spearfishing particularly is interesting because you are, at least the way I teach it, you are hunting.
Yeah.
You're not killing, you are hunting. And you're getting to know your environment. You are hunting and gathering your own food, your own seafood, in the most sustainable, selective, and responsible way. And more often than not, it's about removing the ego. It's not about catching the fish and posting it on Instagram. That looks cool, I admit it. But it's about acknowledging on one breath that you do not want to shoot that fish. It's the wrong species. It's the wrong sex. It's the wrong size. So often not, it's about removing the ego from the equation and not pulling the trigger. So that's very beautiful, I find. It's a very beautiful way to connect where your food comes from. So I think that's my approach to spearfishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I must say, I used to live off of spearfishing when I was in Hawaii. Yeah,
you told me.
With a three-prong, though.
The Hawaiian sling?
Hawaiian sling.
So you know exactly that sensation, right? That sensation of, I got to feed myself, but no.
Also, the chance that that's not the shot. Like, you know the length of the sling. You know your abilities. You know that's not a guarantee. And it's not worth hurting a fish that, you know, you can't guarantee the outcome on. I mean, you can never guarantee an outcome, but you can make a smarter judgment.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you gotta swim away, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And when you don't shoot right because you were nervous, anticipating, the ego came into play, and you see the animal suffering, unless you're a psychopath, the next time you'll be like, I don't want that animal to suffer. I need to practice my shot and be better. It has to be one shot, one kill. When I shoot something, I want to really, that's it. I don't want it to suffer. I'm not religious, but I make a little prayer. I give the fish a kiss. You know, I thank the ocean in a non-religious way, just more of a connection with the ocean way. And then I celebrate, you know, we got food. But I really make sure that, like, that animal should not suffer. That animal is going to go to feed me, my family, my friends, but that animal should not suffer, or suffer as little as possible, which is completely disconnected with everything else in our agricultural system. Our entire food chain system is based on suffering. The chicken, the beef, the pork we eat.
Again, Luca, they can find you on Sea to Sky Freedive.
SeaToSkyFreediving.com, absolutely.
Freediving.com, yeah. And you have a book there too?
Yeah. My blog is The Freedive Wire, and we write articles about science and freediving. Okay. We write gear reviews, travel reviews, and we wrote a book. Well, my buddy, Yap, my partner, wrote the book. I just edited it and helped out as much as I could, but this was pretty much mostly his book. And he wrote this amazing book called Longer and Deeper, and it's about cross-training for freediving and spearfishing. And in the first part of the book, we go into really nerdy science of freediving.
I saw the photos and the graphs just there. Yeah.
We talk about muscle fiber, metabolism, lactate, a bunch of stuff we talked about, testing muscle oxygenation, aerobic, anaerobic metabolism.
Yes.
How you can modify your diet to improve your ATP-CP system. Can the use of creatine and high energy phosphates improve your diving?
And that's then the diet.
Yeah.
The diet. That's another diet. Whole, yeah, I have huge. A whole chapter on that too. I forgot about the diet. Yeah.
And then in the second part of the book, we go into doing like brutal training, like hypoxic deadlift squats. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, really, really like pretty gnarly exercises. It's basically like intermittent high intensity interval training for free diving.
Which is great because you don't need a pool, you know?
And you don't need a pool. That's it.
Love it.
And it was actually, it was endorsed by Aulin Wang, who's the Chinese national record holder. And he's a guy who's landlocked most of the year.
Oh, wow.
But he does a lot of dry training. He'll go to a competition, 100 meters.
Wow.
110 meters.
Yeah, that's cool.
So there's a lot of effectiveness to it. So, yeah.
All right, check it out. Link's going to be down below.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Luca. That was so good. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Wildertainment Podcast. What can you do to help us out? Very minimal. Just fucking go to the Apple Podcast and leave a rating and a review. That's it. Or go on Spotify and subscribe, and on YouTube as well. You know, do the bare minimum. Come on. See you later.